Welcome back, everyone, for our final class of this academic year. What I decided to do for today is to look at an upcoming holiday. And it's an upcoming holiday, which is really this week, which is not even Shavuot, even earlier than that, which is, of course, Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer is coming up this Wednesday night and Thursday. This Thursday is Lag BaOmer. So if anyone has any outings or barbecues, as we call them, mangals in modern Hebrew, a barbecue planned, I hope that you enjoy.
And
they have a
okay. That's
but
very
what
nice.
Do with the Ida Federation event.
All right. So the question is, what is so unique about the date of Lag BaOmer? Now, we had mentioned previously that there was one tradition that the students of Rabbi Akiva, who had previously perished, that they had died in this mysterious plague, that they passed away until the day of Lag BaOmer, and that's when the plague came to a screeching halt. And perhaps that's one of the reasons that we celebrate on Lag BaOmer. That's certainly one traditional retelling of the roots of this particular holiday. But I want to talk today about a different phenomenon which is often, at least traditionally, associated with Lag BaOmer. That this is considered, especially in circles of Kabbalists and people who have mystical inclinations and these sorts of things, is considered to be the Yahrzeit, the day on which we commemorate the passing of one of the great scholars of Jewish history, that of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who's the subject of the title, the trauma of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. A little bit of a word about how this is commemorated nowadays. So we know, for example, that there is, according to tradition, we actually have a grave that is identified as that of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And it is on a mountaintop in the north of Israel in a place known as, anyone know? Place called Meiron. Anyone familiar with this name?
Yeah.
You might have seen it somewhere in the news, because around the time of Lag BaOmer every year in Israel, there are literally thousands, if not tens of thousands of people who ascend to Har Meiron, to Mount Meiron, for what we call, what's often called, the Hilula Dirashbi, which is in Hebrew a reference to Hilula, which is a celebration of Rashbi, which is an acronym in Hebrew for Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, right? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Rashbi. And so this is considered to be the commemoration of the day on which Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai passed away. Now there was one on Lag BaOmer, that's right. Now there was once a time in Jewish history when the day of a Yahrzeit was considered to be a sad day. It's interesting. In the Talmud, in the Gemara, it talks about the notion of fasting, for example, on a Yahrzeit, on the day in which someone passed away. But of course, we know that in the last probably few hundred years, there's been a shift, that a Yahrzeit might be a sad day, but sometimes it's actually comes along with, right, people have Kiddush, they have a little schnapps sometimes. Have you seen, anyone seen this or done this? They have a little bit of schnapps. Anyone see this practice? For a Yahrzeit, ever see this? People, it's an unusual kind of thing when you think about it, because the anniversary of someone's passing, on the face of it, is, right, it's not necessarily, it's not a joyous occasion per se. Well, and yet, in the
Neshama Zolob Ben Aliyah.
Right. So they're right. So there's this idea.
On the other hand, if you lived old and contributed and whatever, you're celebrating.
Right. So that seems to be the idea. And moreover, according to the Hasidic tradition, there's a notion that all the mitzvot, all the blessings that we recite and the performances that we act out on the day of the Yahrzeit all serve as some sort of merit for the soul of the deceased. And so it's considered to be at least a positive opportunity. And so consistent with that Hasidic approach of a more positive way of remembering the day of a Yahrzeit, there is a huge celebration. And because it's Lag BaOmer anyway, so if you go up to Meiron, so if anyone does not yet have travel plans and has a little bit of spare time in your hands, you can book your ticket as soon as we're done. Okay, you can head off to Israel, get there in time, and go from the airport in Lod straight up to Meiron,
where
and hope it's in the north of Israel.
Is that near the
Golan? It's not too far from, it's even higher up. It's not too far from Tzfat, I believe.
From Tzfat.
It's that general.
Be there
it's
that not day.
No, you know.
This Thursday?
This week.
This week.
Not this week.
Not this week. Can it be this Thursday?
But we
where they go.
Oh, we can go. So there you have it.
The kids in Israel, too, that I remember. I just remember where they fit in when my kids were there. Where the kids all go out and have bonfires, you know, and cook.
That's it.
It's not a problem.
That's it.
Yeah. That's it.
It is.
That's it. You got it.
Because it's been all year. I mean, there is not a stick left in that country.
That is it.
That is
it.
It is clean, Israel, because the kids collect
all the fireworks. That is.
In order to go around and make these fires.
That is this Wednesday night. They make, yeah, that's it.
I had a friend, may she rest in peace, whose family went back like 12 generations at Tzfat. And she once went on a family trip back for Lag BaOmer because she wanted remembering where her grandfather, the bonfire started at her grandfather's house.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a big.
It's a fun kind of
it is. It is.
I mean, they had fires everywhere.
Which kids don't like making fires, right?
They do.
Is
yeah.
it anywhere near Atlit? Have you heard?
I have heard of Atlit. I don't think.
Sort of in that direction.
We were there.
Because we're heading off the plane to the Golan area.
Right. I don't think it's there, but I have to. I don't remember for sure.
That's near. Every area near.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So this is considered to be whether it was the original reason for Lag BaOmer or it became an additional aspect of Lag BaOmer. This is, you'll forgive the pun, but this has swept the Jewish people or Israel like wildfire, and it has become incredibly popular. Now, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, I mentioned that it was among mystical circles that this is an especially popular commemoration. Remember, according to at least a very prominent traditional view, the great mystical work of Judaism, of the Kabbalah, the Zohar, at the text of the Zohar, which is considered to be the single greatest work of Jewish mysticism. According to tradition, that was ascribed to this earlier author, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, we're talking about going back to the second century of the Common Era. So we're going back nearly 2,000 years. And according to tradition, he was the author. And this was a sacred book that was kept in secret and was transmitted only from teacher to student because it could not be taught in particularly wide circles. And at some point, the decision was made to make it somewhat broader so that the mystical secrets do not become lost, or so because later generations were considered less meritorious and they needed the secret teachings of the mystical tradition in order to enlighten people of their generation, whatever it might be. But originally, the Zohar was considered to be, according to this tradition, a secret, a clandestine document that could only be taught by certain people, to certain people. At least that was the traditional view among many for long, that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And in these circles that tend to celebrate Meiron, at least the more, again, Hasidically or mystically inclined circles, that is the working assumption among many. There are other scholars who have questioned this, and that's a class for another time. But at least according to that particular tradition, that was considered to be the common view. So now what we have is that in addition to the students of Rabbi Akiva, this persona of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai becomes an extremely central one in our tradition, at least around Lag BaOmer. And so I wanted to take the opportunity to learn a little bit about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Just offhand, is anyone familiar with any biographical details? There's a story that's well known, we're going to come to in a few minutes, about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai being hidden in a cave. Anyone familiar with this story? Is this ringing a bell with anyone?
Yes.
A cave?
I remember a story about a cave.
Okay, there's a cave.
Right. He didn't have any clothes and he was in sand.
Well, he was fleeing from someone. From whom was he fleeing? If you were living in the second century of the Common Era and you were living in Israel, you would probably flee from the Romans. Right? That's exactly what it was. And we're going to see more about that. So what I want to do is a little bit is to...
We did a lot of fleeing in our
race. We did. But if you were in the second century of the Common Era and you had to flee into a cave, you would think it was the Romans. It was, So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is a very interesting personality, not only because of that story, but because there is a certain association with him. And I would say if there's one word that I would identify with the historic... Leaving aside the whole piece about the Zohar and the Kabbalistic literature, because that already... It's a later tradition that he was the author. But I mean, in terms of the Talmud itself, what it has to tell about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, I would probably term him a purist. A purist. What do I mean that he was a purist? What I mean is that he's associated very often with the view that one needs to focus one's entire life and energy on the study of Torah, on the observance of commandments. In fact, there is a suggestion, which we'll see in a few moments, that perhaps one should not even go out and work, that it would be ideal for someone to just put everything else aside. Okay, and we'll see there are other scholars who hotly disputed him, and we do not follow that, of course, but Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's approach was what we call Torah only. Put everything else aside and only focus on certain very specific pursuits. And I want to ask sort of how he came to this and what was the story of his life that perhaps informed some of his opinions, but we'll also see the possibility of a shift later on in his life. And what I want to explore is sort of the story, the life story. We don't know for sure. It is conjectural to try to kind of take different passages of the Talmud and piece them together to come up with sort of a larger puzzle. Not sure anyone has read the novel by Rabbi Milton Steinberg as a Driven Leaf.
Yes.
Okay? It's a marvelous book, okay?
First Hadassah book.
All right, there you go. Okay, As a Driven Leaf. So As a Driven Leaf is a much more sophisticated, textually based attempt at a similar kind of project. What did he do? He took the life of one of the famous heretics of the Talmud, named Elisha ben Avuya, also known in the Talmud as Acher, the other one, because he left the traditional path. And what he does is he compiles stories from the Babylonian Talmud and from the Israeli Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi, Palestinian Talmud, and he takes other midrashic materials and he kind of collects all of them and he tries to develop a composite portrait. Happens to be a relatively sympathetic portrait of this individual, of how his encounters with the rabbis ultimately led him to make the decisions that he made. It's a fascinating cry. It's sort of historical fiction, but closely based on the history. We don't know that this is exactly the course of events, and it's told with a certain kind of approach, but it's an attempt to take all these different sources and kind of put them together in a meaningful way. So this is far less comprehensive. And this is far less sophisticated than the work that Rabbi Steinberg did. It's obviously far short of a novel. It's just a class. But it's similar in the methodology. Few Talmudic passages about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Let's try to kind of stitch them together and see if anything interesting emerges from this portrait. Okay, so let's start with one or two passages in which we see this purism that I had mentioned about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. The first one appears in the Talmud in Tractate Brachot. This is source number one. This is in Brachot, which is the very first of the 63 tractates of the Talmud. This is number one. This is the very first, Brachot, blessings, and this is page 35b from the Talmud. So the passage here in the Gemara, we're going to see it in English, the Gemara poses a question. So the Gemara says, I don't understand, there is a contradiction. Let's start from about eight lines down in the English, where it says on page one, our rabbis have taught. And I apologize, a little bit small. We'll read a little bit inside and we'll do a lot of it outside as well. I'm about eight or nine lines down in the English. Everyone sees our rabbis have taught. Apologize, a little bit small. Now, rabbis have taught. So there's a phrase that is cited, and it says in the Bible, and thou shalt gather in thy corn. Right? Everyone sees that? Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. Good. So you're going to gather in your corn. Where is that from? It's actually from the Shema. It says that if you perform all the commandments, the asafta deganecha, you will gather in your corn and your harvest, etc. So in other words, if the Jews perform the commandments, then we will have substantial harvest. We'll have will have food in abundance. So the Talmud asks, says right after the little hyphen, there on that line, what has this teaching to tell us? Right? In other words, what is this passage in the verse trying in the Bible trying to teach? Since it is written, this book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, out of your mouth. Right? In other words, it says in the book of Joshua that God instructs Joshua. He says, no, you should always be studying. Don't go and work out in the fields. Right? You should focus on your study. It is possible to think that these words are to be understood as they are written. That you should literally what? Study Torah all day, right? All day and all night. And therefore the verse comes along in the Shema and says, no. Vasafta deganecha, you should even gather your corn. In other words, there's a time for your Torah study and for your one kind of pursuit, or religious pursuit in that way. And then there's a place for also simply going out into the world, an occupation, etc. And therefore, there is a teaching to say, thou shalt gather in thy corn. You should gather, right? You should work in the field, i.e., in other words, conduct at the same time a worldly occupation. These are the words of Rabbi Ishmael. So one of the, what we call the Tanaitic scholars, the Tanaim, which means a scholar from the time of the Mishnah, Rabbi Ishmael, he maintains, how do we resolve these two verses? It's very simple. There's a time for one, there's a time for the other. God says to Joshua, study Torah. He also tells the Jewish people, you shall go and ingather your corn. And the answer is, there's a time for one, there's a time for the other, and they're all important in the larger scheme. Okay, good. And there are many who had to do that.
You can do that.
You can dance at two. We call that dancing at two weddings. You can do both at the same time.
Yeah.
What?
It goes on to say, in order to do that.
Yeah.
Goes on by others.
Oh, that's going to be the other view.
That's the wives. The women.
Okay, and that's not what it says. No.
That's what my son's father-in-law said to him. There's both things he can do.
Yeah.
And I have the engagement.
The night of the engagement, just remember, he's in rabbinical school.
Yeah.
Great-grandson, Danny. Yeah. So as a reminder, you know, you can still get a good living, make a good job for a good Jewish boy. Okay. All right. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai says, so now we come to our scholar, our hero, Rabbi Shimon, the son of Yochai. What does he say? He says, nonsense. It's not possible to do both. Okay, this is the protagonist of this class, with a very harsh, purist kind of statement, quite frankly. Is it possible for a man to plow at the time of plowing, sow at seed time, reap at harvest time, thresh at the time of threshing, and winnow at the time of wind? What is to become of the Torah? He says, that's very nice in theory, but let me tell you, in practice, it doesn't always work that way. By the time you're finished working in the field to support your family, I got news for you. There ain't no time left for anything else. Okay? I don't know if anyone else has ever felt like that or at any point in their lives. Okay? He says, what is to become of Torah? So he says, no. Says, but when Israel performed the will of the All-Present, when they perform the will of God, their work is done by others. It's taken care of for you. As it is said, and strangers shall stand and feed your flocks. Okay? Someone's going to take care of it for you. Don't worry about it. God has his messengers. And at the time when Israel perform not the will of the All-Present, their work has to be done by themselves, as it is said, and thou shalt gather that in thy corn. And then it goes on and says that not only that, but if you don't do God's will, you'll actually not only have to do the work yourself, you have to do the work for your enemies as well. You're going to have to serve them too. So in other words, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai has a different resolution to the apparent contradiction. We said we had one verse that says, study Torah. The other verse says, harvest your grain. So the first view, Rabbi Ishmael, says very simple. The answer is, sometimes you do this, sometimes you do that. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, nonsense. It's not possible to do both. It's not possible to seriously study Torah and seriously earn a living. It's just not going to happen. So he says, rather what it means is, okay, it depends on the circumstance. If we do the will of God, and the rest is taken care of for us, okay? And if we do not perform the will of God, not only will we have to do the work, but we're going to have to do the work of others as well. Now, check this. Check out the continuation of the Talmud. So there's a comment from a later scholar, a Talmudic scholar, after the time of the Mishnah, but around the time of the Talmud, which is that of Abaye. So Abaye says like this. So Abaye explains, he says, if you look at the fourth to last line on the first page, Abaye said, many acted in accord with the teaching of Rabbi Ishmael, and it proved efficacious. So he said, there were many who followed the view of Rabbi Ishmael, who says sometimes you work and sometimes you study. Okay? But he, and that worked out. But he who acted in accord with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai did not find it so. So he says, in other words, that's very nice for you, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, that you're just going to study Torah all day long, and somehow you're going to put food on your table. So, but there, that's very nice. But many had tried that, and guess what? It did not end very well. So the Talmud basically rejects this as an unrealistic perspective, and continues for some, and the Gemara actually ultimately rejects this view and says, maybe there were earlier generations, whatever it may have, but the bottom line is that this is not a practical view. Despite the fact that the Talmud itself ultimately rejects the view of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and I think we can agree that maybe there should be a handful of students who are studying in Torah to study to become rabbis and to help service the community and lead the community, but for the majority, the overwhelming majority of population, the traditional view has always been that we should have educations, and we should prepare ourselves to get jobs and to support ourselves and our families.
Be despite all of that, community where you find yourself.
Absolutely. Despite all of that, not Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Right? He was a little bit of a rebel, and I say a purist. He said, no, it's not possible to do both. You've got to study Torah. Now, we already start to see this sense, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, at least in these sources, right? Nothing else, Torah only. In fact, there's another passage, I did not reproduce it here, but it cites Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai as follows. He says something remarkable, which I think goes a step further. He says, if I had my way, I would have gone to God and asked him to create me with two mouths. Now that might sound like an anti-Semitic stereotype, like it's on the list, you know, long nose and horns and two mouths or something like that, and a tail to boot. But no, he didn't mean it in that way. He goes on to explain. He says, well, I speak in two ways about two types of matters, about Torah or religious matters, and then I speak about secular matters. He says, in this case, look, even Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai agrees that you have to speak about secular matters. At some point, you can't function. Even the one who says you should study Torah only, at some point, if you're traveling, you don't know where to go, you know, you can go, you know, like that's just not very practical. Right? Okay? It's not, what would you like to order for dinner tonight? You know, it's just, it's not going to end well. And it'll be a chilul Hashem probably to boot. So even Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai agrees that you need to speak, but he says, I want to sharply separate between that which is sacred and that which is secular, and I wish I could have asked God, as it were, he would have created me with literally two lips, two mouths. I mean, a very striking kind of statement. Do you see what I'm saying? That he's the one who takes the religious and the secular, he seems to be separating them out, and seems to be saying, as much as I can, I want to separate the secular out, winnow it out, as it were, and focus just on that which is holy, that which is sacred, that which is pure.
So, from the profane. Sorry.
From the profane.
It's
exactly
kind of like
right.
That little, not quite as meaning to this, that little quote about, you know, if God wanted you to speak twice as much as he wanted you to listen, he would have given you two mouths and one ear.
That's right.
So
that's right. So now what's interesting is he does not answer the question, so why did God not create me in that way? Right? What are the theological implications? Maybe it actually shows the opposite, that even that which is secular has an aspect of sacredness that's has a certain potential for that and can be uplifted, which I think is really the Jewish philosophy, or the more common Jewish view. That even that which is secular, actually it's interesting, at Kohelet we do not say secular studies. for mathematics and for English, etc., we actually intentionally call that general studies. There's Torah studies and general studies. And the idea is that there's no study, that at least that we're teaching our students, that we believe is inherently purely secular, that all wisdom is ultimately God's wisdom, and we can actually see the genius of the Almighty through our biology labs or by studying higher mathematics or what have you, that all of these have offer us the opportunity, of course, to study in order to be accepted into college and to earn a living, etc. Absolutely, but also to see the divine hand.
Curriculums can be also and should be intertwined.
Absolutely.
They should be across
sure, absolutely.
All of them, whether it's Jewish and non-Jewish, right. Whatever, should be intertwined the same way biology, let's say English. And
sure.
There should be this.
So there are ways in which when we think about things in a more integrated kind of way, it enlightens, right? There's a mutually enhancing effect there. Absolutely, 100%. We try to do that as best we can. So that's a little bit about, just to give a sense of where Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is holding. And where this is often traced back to is the story that I mentioned earlier about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and the cave. But first, a little bit of background. And this is a story that we read in Tractate Shabbat in source 2 on page 33b. So this is about the Jewish interaction with the Romans. So let's see what happens here. So page 2 in the on the English side, after it says Shabbat 33b, it says, and why? So the Talmud asks, says, and why is Rabbi Yehuda called the first of the speakers? There was a scholar called Rabbi Yehuda. He was called the first of the speakers. And the Talmud wants to know why. And it answers by way of a story. Right? Jews either answer questions by way of
other questions,
or if you don't have another question, then I guess you can tell a story. So he says, since Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon sat together, it's because there was this incident, these three rabbis were sitting together, and Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Gerim, of converts, sat with them. So there was a Rabbi Yehuda who his lineage was from a unique family of converts, and he was with them as well. So the Talmud says as follows. Rabbi Yehuda opened and said, so he was the first one to talk, and he had only positive things to say about the Romans. How fine are the deeds of the Roman nation? They set up markets, they set up bridges, they set up bathhouses. They've accomplished some wonderful things in terms of the infrastructure that they have set. Now remember, this is at a time of intense Roman religious persecution against the Jews. Despite that, Rabbi Yehuda tries to find something positive to say about the Romans. He says, well, at minimum, they know how to build things, right? They can set up infrastructure. So that's something positive that I can say. Rabbi Yossi was quiet. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, so he's right, he's the purist. So what does he say? He says, nonsense. He answered and said, all that they set up, they did not set up except for their own needs. They set up, and again, this is blunt, they set up markets to place prostitutes in them, bathhouses to pamper themselves, bridges, and this is the ultimate insult always, to take taxes, right? This is from the time of the Talmud to the time of 21st century politics. Nothing has changed. Okay, they're trying to take our taxes away. Okay, right, so he has only negative things to say, even about that. Rabbi Yehuda ben Gerim went and told over their words. So this Jew was actually an informant, and he told their words over to the government. And they were heard by the government. The government officials said, Yehuda, that rabbi that elevated us, should be elevated. Says they're going to give him a promotion because they heard he said very good things about the local Roman government. Yossi, that was quiet, should be exiled to Tzipori. So he's right; he's being sent off. Right, Tzipori also in the north of Israel. Shimon, that disgraced us, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Right, forget about it. Off with his head. He should be killed. So he had to, just like Moses, he had to flee. Right, so he fled from his enemies. He and his son went and hid in the study hall every day. His wife would bring them bread and a container of water, and they ate. So they were hiding out, studying Torah, and they just ate the minimal necessary to survive. When the decree became more pronounced, he said to his son, He actually wrote this is something, right? This is a women's statement. That weak resolve, maybe the Roman, he was worried that his wife or one of the women in their family would give in. Maybe the Romans will distress her and she'll reveal our location. They're going to torture, in other words, they're going to torture his wife or someone in his family. They went, presumably his wife, and they went and hid in a cave in order that she not be tortured. So this is the cave story. Okay, page 3, everyone has it? Top of page 3, second line. A miracle occurred, and a carob tree and a spring of water were created for them. This is our Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the same one. Right? And they would take off their clothes and would sit up with their necks in sand. The whole, because it was so, so uncomfortable. The whole day, they would study. At the time of prayers, they would get dressed, cover themselves and pray. Then they would go back and take off their clothes so they would not get worn out. They sat for 12 years in the cave. Okay, 12 years in the cave. And now, of course, they're in a cave for 12 years, so who's going to show his face? Okay, there was already a miracle, so, right? There was a carob tree and a spring, so it's going to be Elijah, right? Eliyahu, the prophet, came and stood at the entrance of the cave and said, who will inform Bar Yochai, right? Our hero, our protagonist, that the Caesar has died and that his decree has been annulled. Free to come out after hiding from the Roman authorities for 12 years. They came out. Now this is where it comes to our point. They came out and they saw people that were plowing and planting. Does this sound familiar? Mm-hmm. What does Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai think about people who are plowing and planting? Okay, he's not happy about it. So look at this. After he emerges from the cave, Rabbi Shimon said, they are leaving over eternal life and involving themselves with temporary life. This is the same person, right? He's not very happy about it. And then the Talmud goes further. Every place upon which they would set their eyes would
burn.
Immediately burn. A heavenly voice came out and said to them, okay, so now you know what God thinks about this. Did you come out of the cave to destroy my world? Right? Okay, so what does he do? Go back to your cave. He says, if you want to live in a cave, fine. But the cave is not going to work in the real world. They returned and went back. They sat for 12 months of the year. They then said, the judgment of the wicked is 12 months in Gehenna, in hell. So in other words, that was their punishment for this poor behavior. A heavenly voice, hopefully they've been purified by purgatory, as it were. A heavenly voice came out and said, go out from your cave. They came out again. Every place that Rabbi Eliezer would strike, Rabbi Shimon would heal. So in other words, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai has sort of learned a lesson, and he actually becomes a healer. He said for him, my son, you and I are enough for the world. And he actually goes on to say that he sees that the Jews are performing the mitzvot, they're running to light the candles before Shabbat, and their minds are ultimately put at ease, and he no longer burns up the crops that he sees and so on and so forth. Okay. So on the one hand, this is a story in which Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is, we see him in a way at his worst, his most extreme, right? He sees people working out in the field and he says, I already told you my opinion about people who are working out in the fields. That's problematic. So what does God do?
Sends him.
Says, you're not ready for my world yet. Then he comes out. And what does he do? Does he burn the fields anymore?
No.
And in fact, he becomes some sort of miracle healer.
Well,
now, he's still...
He begins to look for the positive. Look for what they are doing, not what they're not doing.
There you go. Okay? So, is it possible that in this incident there is a sort of a turning point, almost, in the life of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? Now, I wanna trace that perhaps a little bit further and suggest that that's the case. But before we do that, I wanna, now having gotten a sort of a sense as the life of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, I wanna press the rewind button a little bit in this narrative, in the biography, and go back to an earlier incident in the life of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and perhaps, I don't know, perhaps a suggestion about what happened. I don't know. But it's just another incident that I think would be important. And then we'll come back and we'll wrap up by looking at one more text in the Talmud and see how perhaps Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai transforms. changes, comes to perhaps a new understanding over the course of his life. So those are the two additional texts or stories that I want to look at. The first one is the, I guess, these days it's popular to talk about Back to the Future, right? There was actually, right, because of the date, you know that movie, right, Back to the Future? So the date that they predicted he was going to took place a few months ago, right? I forget exactly which date. Anyone? I don't know if anyone remembers. But they went ahead in the future and in the movie, and we actually, it was a few months ago, the actual date which they were fast-forwarding to was actually coming up on the calendar. So now instead of going ahead, I want to actually go back to the earlier time of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Okay, it's a story that at first glance has nothing to do with him, and this one I'll do outside. I'll share it with you, and then I'll share with you the punchline of this story, the younger version of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So here's how the story goes. This takes us back to Tractate Brachot again. So here's the next piece. So we know that in the Jewish tradition, how many times a day do we generally pray?
Three
prayers a day, with the morning prayers, the afternoon, and then evening prayers. There was a dispute. It was universally accepted in Talmudic times that the morning and afternoon prayers are mandatory on some level. You have to say something. The evening prayer, however, there was a dispute. Is it obligatory or is it
optional
or voluntary? That was an argument in the Talmudic times. Is it chova, mandatory, or is it reshut, optional? Back and forth they went. The scholars disputed this. One said this way, one said the other way. Major, major arguments among the sages about this question. Now, at this time, it happened to be there was a yeshiva, there was a study hall, there was a school, as it were, the Talmud tells us, and it was headed by the Nasi. The Nasi was the elected official for the Jewish community. Happened to be that rabbi at the time was someone by the name of Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel, he was the leader, perhaps. You've heard about Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel was a little bit of a stickler. He was a disciplinarian. He believed that you state whatever your opinion, but in the end of the day, everyone needs to fall in line. That was his view. Now, we heard about one of these young whippersnapper scholars who opposed his view about whether or not the evening prayer was mandatory. Rabban Gamliel said, it is mandatory. There was a Rabbi Joshua who disagreed. And so, there's a whole story. But before that story unfolds, the first thing that happens is a very innocent question. A student, as it were, raises his hand and says, Rabbi, what's the ruling? The Talmud says, there was a student, a Talmud, that's all it says, a student. What's the ruling? Do we hold that the evening prayer is mandatory, or is it optional? So Rabban Gamliel says, in his inimitable style, he said, will someone stand up and tell me what the ruling is? So no one stood up. So Rabban Gamliel says, well, the ruling is that it's mandatory. Does anyone disagree? Anyone disagree? Of course, he knew full well that there was someone who disagreed. First, nobody stands up. And Rabban Gamliel says, is there anyone here who disagrees? So they actually answered that it was obligatory. So he said, well, we all know the truth, because doesn't Rabbi Joshua disagree and maintain that it is optional? So Rabbi Gamliel responds and says, well, why doesn't everyone wait here until all the students are in the Beit Midrash? They're all in the study hall, including Rabbi Joshua. Rabbi Joshua comes in, Rabbi Yoshua, and everyone's filled. You know, they know something's going on. So everyone, right? They're not going to miss this one. This is going to be fireworks. Rabbi Gamliel stands up at the lectern, as it were, and he pounds and he demands, is there anyone who disagrees with me that the evening prayer is mandatory? That's what he says. And, of course, ultimately, right? Actually, the first thing that happens, Rabbi Joshua says, no, no one disagrees. Everyone, it's unanimous. So Rabban Gamliel confronts him finally and says, well, I mean, they've been quoting to me from you, in your name, that it is optional. I mean, fess up, Rabbi Joshua. So there's a whole story, and basically Rabbi Gamliel embarrasses him publicly. And it's a terrible, it's a very, very sad incident. In fact, it gets so bad, Rabbi Gamliel so terribly embarrasses Rabbi Joshua, that ultimately the other scholars get together, and they make a decision that Rabbi Gamliel is so severe a personality that he needs to be deposed. That's how bad it is. They say, well, there was this other incident in which he embarrassed that scholar. In this case, he shamed this one. Now he's disgraced Rabbi Yehoshua. I mean, how long is this going to go on? I mean, it's one thing to demand that there be a final opinion, but you're going to publicly embarrass one of your students for what purpose?
Must be the formula for
what reason?
Politics of today.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Sounds a little familiar.
What? Okay. So, in this case, they stood up. The other scholars stood up and they said, this is not happening, okay? Let this be a lesson. So anyhow, that's the story. They actually depose him. It's a very sad incident. But they come to the defense of Rabbi Yehoshua. Ultimately, Rabbi Gamliel apologizes, but they had already appointed another person in his stead, and they come up with a compromise. One of them is going to serve as the head of the yeshiva for some weeks, another one for other weeks. The whole complicated compromise that they come to in the end, in this whole very difficult episode, and it takes about a page of Talmud. The very end of the story, the Gemara, literally the last words that are often overlooked in the story, the Gemara says, the bottom of page 4, one very short and simple line, and the disciple, in other words, the one who asked the original question, was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. It was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So in other words, here we have this whole difficult, even traumatic episode in which the leader of the yeshiva, but not just the yeshiva, this was a position over the, it is a community-wide position for the Jewish community of Israel at that time. This entire difficult story, the embarrassment, the shame, the deposing, the election of a new leader, then the apology, the compromise that we're going to have the original leader together with a new leader, all of this was spurred by a young man. And who was that young man?
Simeon.
Interestingly
Simeon.
Enough.
Simeon.
Right? Our hero, right? Or the subject of our story, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And I was asking myself as I studied this with some of my students here in the school, does this have any connection with, right? Does this have any connection with our story? What do you think? Is this story in which he was the student who asked the question, little shy student in the back, who asked this question, does that have any relationship with what we've seen about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? I'm not sure it does, but I wanted to raise the question. What do you think? What do you think he experienced as a student in this case? Let's put ourselves in his place.
An argument that occurs.
Okay. How do you think he would have felt about his role in this entire incident? This young student who raises his hand, asks a question, and it leads to
chaos.
Right? Okay. Do you think he felt positively about this?
No.
I don't think so.
Probably not. Now, we don't know. This is conjectural. We don't know how he felt about it.
Absolutely not.
We have no idea for sure. I wonder aloud, though, if he may have even blamed himself. I don't know.
For starting the mess.
Right?
I think he really just wanted a ruling.
Right, of course he wasn't. No, we don't really know for sure.
He might have.
Maybe he thought maybe it's not a good idea to make waves.
Right?
No, he didn't.
Okay, good. Do you think that someone. Now we know that he hid in a cave because of the Romans for 12 years. That's true. But do you get the sense that that was a difficult experience for him, or that he actually felt quite comfortable as the kind of person who might live in a cave?
Oh, no.
Right? Now, no one likes living in a cave for 12 years, but...
Depends on the cave.
Depends on the prison, right?
Here with the
cave.
It was a
possible experience for something. without any...
any distractions, without having to engage with anyone. Sometimes, this is conjectural, but I wonder if maybe part of what happened for Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is that as a young student, he experienced a tremendous trauma. He basically caused, he felt, he did not cause, but maybe he felt that he had, because he had opened up and engaged with the entire yeshiva, that his involvement in the political, unintentionally, completely unintentional, with the political community, as it were, and structures at the time, led to utter chaos and to the downfall of the great leader of Israel and his deposition and everything. One could imagine that possibly... what was his instinct? To recoil. What would he think about public life after an incident like that? Probably. Right, probably
Pandora's
he'd be the kind...
box, right? Pandora's box.
It's a, I mean, you know what happens when someone undergoes a trauma. Again, this is conjectural, but... right, if someone undergoes a trauma... all right, and they encounter a similar scenario. How do they respond?
They withdraw.
They withdraw. They don't want to engage with that in the first place.
Right.
Now, we don't know.
What if it was the opposite?
What?
What if it was the opposite?
Yeah.
In other words, if the ruling at that time was something that he, somewhere in his mind, didn't have clear, so that in fact he, you know, I mean, he's a student and he's obviously smart, meant for this to happen, that he wanted to start the dialogue. He didn't know it would take it where he took it, but he was intentionally starting the dialogue. He wouldn't ask the question if he didn't intend to start that dialogue.
It's entirely possible.
He had some idea where it was going to lead.
And ultimately, we don't know. It's our best guess. We really don't know. But I can tell you, I did not give it to you here, but there's a comment of Rashi. Rashi says that it was difficult for him. Rashi says on this line that it was difficult because he saw what had happened. So Rashi at least thinks it was traumatic or difficult, but you're right, we do not know for sure.
It is a mystery.
Now, so my
Kabbalah is a mystery.
Well, that's true, right? It fits. That Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's life is entire is a great point. That his entire life is so mysterious is fitting because his life story is hard to fit together and to try to understand what are the ramifications of this event moving forward, it is hard to know. So that
Why would he then take a middle road? What I'm thinking is, you see, that if he was going to be so far to the right, let's say, and it caused all this trauma by asking the question, it seems to me that he might have taken a more liberal point of view, a more central point of view, so that he wouldn't rock any boats. If it really upset him that much that he rocked the boat, why would you then continue with your life rocking the boat?
That's fair. But I think that especially this idea of not wanting to engage and just kind of staying to yourself within these sort of very delimited parameters, you know, I do think that might have emerged from, you know, like, just leave me to my study, leave me to my books, don't engage me with anything. And so the ideal, his own ideal, becomes one of just a scholar who's almost hermetically sealed from society. Now, I think that gets broken, and I think it changes, and I want to share with you why. So if you take a look at the last source that I have here, there's something very unusual. So I'll do this one outside. This is in Menachot, which is really a separate discussion about the showbread that they used to have in the temple, etc., that the priests would eat. Well, I'll share this with you outside. The last side, page 5 of 5. The English here is not the entire English translation. Let me share this with you outside. I'll share you sort of the punchline of this passage. It's a very interesting discussion here about whether, similar to the Talmud that we saw, the passage at the beginning of Brachot, is one obligated to study Torah constantly? That's the question. Is one obligated to study Torah all the time? Okay. So that's the question that the Gemara poses. Now, what's unusual about this discussion is that here, Rabbi Yossi, another scholar, actually... who is that? One second, let me look. There's one view in the Talmud. This is Rabbi Yishmael, Okay, Rabbi Shon, same Rabbi Shon as earlier, who says, you know what, it's a constant obligation to study Torah. Obviously, you have to sometimes take breaks. There are, you know, you're allowed to use the restroom. You know, you're allowed even maybe even to make a living. But as much as what is possible, when one has free time, you have to put everything else society says and study Torah. Comes along none other than Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in this passage, and he says, nonsense. There is no constant obligation of Torah study. He says, it says that you have to study in the morning and at night. The verse also from Joshua, that same section. V'hagita bo yomam v'layla. You shall study it, the Torah, day and night. So therefore, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai himself says what?
Yes.
Says, you study once in the morning, a little bit still here, a little bit at night. Look, if you want to study more, that's wonderful. That's an aspiration. But the level of obligation, one is obligated to study, so that's a little bit in the morning, a little bit at night. That's what he says. Now, come along many of the classical commentators and they say, hold on one second. The same Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. This is a glaring contradiction. Remember, in the very first passage that we studied about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, what did he say? Right? Okay.
Continuously.
And he said, how are you going to make a living?
Others will do.
God will prevail.
Okay, right?
Oh, who
right?
provided the carob tree and the water?
Okay, what?
Who provided the carob
right?
tree and the water?
And the cave, right? The cave, that's how he lived in the cave for 12 years. And when he first came out of the cave, which did he live like? Which story? The one in Brachot, right? I mean, he said, oh, what are they doing out in the fields? And so he burned the stalks of, you know, wheat or whatever, corn, whatever it might have been. So that was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So many of the classical commentaries, they come along and they say, what gives? This seems to be an outright contradiction. It cannot be that the same Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai who said that one must study all day and all night, and the Parnassah knew it'll take care of itself, that's the same Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai who, when asked how constant is the obligation of Torah study, says, I do abyssal in the morning, I do abyssal at night, okay? It's like a, you know, it's like a recipe over a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and you're done. I mean, this cannot possibly be the same person. And so many of the later day commentators give a range of explanations. They explain it this way, they explain it that way, lots of different approaches. But I want to share with you the view, the explanation that I heard actually from my wife's grandfather. My wife's grandfather, you may have heard the name, is Rabbi Norman Lamb. Rabbi Norman Lamb served as the president, you've heard of it, Rabbi, he served as the president of Yeshiva University for 27 years. He's now retired, but he is a very prominent leader in the American Jewish community. So Rabbi Lamb has a book, and I discussed this with him at times, on a few occasions. So he explains in and out. Said, there's a different explanation, and it's historical in nature. He says they are both Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, but they represent very different positions. You know what the difference is? One position he maintains before he went into the cave, and the second position he held after he came out. The second time is exactly right.
He says, in fact,
that's more entrenched in his view. He said that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, remember how the Talmud describes those 12 months as Gehenim for him, as a period of Klaidon, right? Not just the physical suffering, but right, it was purgatory in the sense of it was cathartic, it was cleansing for him. In other words, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, whether it was because of a traumatic episode in his childhood, whether it was just because that was his innate view, whatever it may have happened, he started off his life maintaining the view of Torah only, a very purist kind of approach to life. That's what he said about going to work. He said, nonsense. He said, give me two mouths, because the secular and the the secret and the profane are completely distinct. And when he came out of the cave the first time, he had probably been even more fully or more deeply entrenched, right? Nothing good to say about anyone else, not least of anyone, the Romans, right? And so he became deepened in that. Comes out of the cave, he starts burning the crops, and God says, you know what? Now you've gone too far. You've got to learn a lesson. If you're going to go out, see people earning a living, and you're going to burn their crops alive, the work of their labor, you can no longer live in my world. If you want to focus on Torah, beautiful. There's nothing more. Rabbi Shlomo Reichai, you should be studying Torah all day long. But you need to have a place in your worldview and in your life experience for those who are doing the important work of feeding their families, of taking our country, nowadays that would be the equivalent, our people, moving them forward in an agricultural sense, in terms of the economic security of their families, of the Jewish people. If you do not have a space for that, I'm sending you right back where you came from. Don't come out until you're ready to engage with the world in a different way. Now, I don't believe that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai came out of the cave and it was like that. That, I think, is unrealistic for any human being. And indeed, he needs to be consoled. He needs to see them not just working the field, but also running to light what? What did he see? Them running to light the Shabbat candles, which is practical, but also spiritual at the same time. And they're running to do something. It's not just Torah study, but it's a mitzvah.
They weren't
ignoring. It's for,
but they did it in their own time.
Exactly. That you can do both. That you can keep the mitzvahs and still work the field, and you don't have to choose among the two. So comes along Rabbi Lam, he suggests this was the story or the evolution of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. That Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, at the beginning of his life, was a purist. He believed in a sharp distinction between the sacred and the profane, and he believed the Torah only, but God saw fit to remind him and to demand from him, that will not work in the world that I have created. Torah study is essential, spiritual observant, crucial. Without that, we don't continue our heritage. We don't observe the mitzvot. Something fundamental is lacking. But it needs to be balanced by someone working the field, engaging with material life, and by the lesson that the two can coexist. And by the end of his life, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai comes to the conclusion, you know what? There are some people for whom it's okay to study a little bit of Torah in the morning, study a little bit of Torah in the night. In other words, their spiritual world is anchored around the values of Torah, but that does not require them to actually be engaged in Torah study in the narrow sense every single moment of their lives. They can spend time with their grandchildren, for God's sake. They can live normal everyday lives, even as they are anchored in the spiritual worldview of Torah and everything that it represents. To me, that is the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, a personal journey which required God's intercession in order for him to learn that his extreme approach has a place for him, but not necessarily in terms of a wider worldview. What I think ultimately the story is trying to remind us is exactly this, that it's possible to have both. That doesn't mean it's always easy. That does not mean that there are sometimes conflicts. Of course there are, but it's possible for one to be a spiritually oriented person, study Torah, keep the mitzvot, etc., at the same time be a normal person, to take those and put them together. That, I think, is very much the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and to me, that is a life lesson that when it comes to Lag BaOmer that I think we can very much celebrate and be proud of and see for ourselves, for our families, for our children, grandchildren, and that I think ultimately is the legacy of this great scholar's own life journey of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So that was what I wanted to share for today in advance of Lag BaOmer. Thank you. As always, it is a little bit sad for us to have the final class of the academic year. I'm always available if there's anything that you find related to what we've been learning and you want to be in touch about it, talk about it. I'm around through the summer, so I'd love to continue the conversations. And once I have my schedule for next year, we'll talk about next year. I don't ever know.
We
at this point, I don't know.
Meeting.
Yeah.